probably the very first time where the U.S. and the Taliban have actually agreed to a blueprint toward a peace process.
A draft peace deal is unveiled for Afghanistan. It's Wednesday, January 30th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a university professor runs into a language barrier, a solar-powered airport, cleanup in Manila Bay, blockchain tracks coffee, and fast melting ice. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Afghan reconciliation is urging direct talks between the Taliban and the Kabul government, as he confirmed details in a draft peace deal aimed at ending the 17-year conflict in the country. Zalmay Khalilzad told the New York Times in Kabul that the deal framework would have to be fleshed out before it becomes an agreement, but stressed the Taliban have committed to our satisfaction to do what is necessary that would prevent Afghanistan from ever becoming a platform for international terrorist groups or individuals. In return, the United States may be willing to give in to the prime Taliban demand of withdrawing its troops from the country, given that other conditions, including a comprehensive ceasefire and the start of a dialogue with Kabul, are met. Michael Kugelman has been writing and talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan for years. He is the deputy director of the Asia Program and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and also a leading specialist on Afghanistan, India, and Pakistan and their relations with the United States. He tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman via Skype what he thinks of the latest revelations from the U.S. Taliban talks.
I must say that in the many years that I've covered Afghanistan, I've never been so optimistic about the idea of a possible peace agreement there. This is probably the very first time where the U.S. and the Taliban have actually agreed to a blueprint toward a peace process that includes a commitment to finding agreement on the biggest issues for both sides, which includes for the Taliban, getting the U.S. to agree to a troop withdrawal plan, and for the U.S., getting the Taliban to renounce any ties to international terrorism, and getting the Taliban to agree to a ceasefire followed by negotiations with the Afghan government to end the war. So there's clearly a long way to go, for sure, a really long way to go. It's premature to say we're close to a peace deal, we're close to ending the war. We're not. But I think that we've come to uncharted territory here, and I think that in of itself is encouraging.
What about these roadblocks? Number one being that the Afghan government has to be included in talks, something they've refused.
The main roadblock for sure is the continued refusal of the Taliban to bring Kabul into talks. And that's a very serious issue. I mean, it's absurd to think that you could move toward a peace process without including the Afghan government. It just doesn't make any sense. But, unfortunately, I think that the Taliban is serious that they do not want to talk to the Afghan government until it reaches an agreement with the United States on a troop withdrawal plan. And though they've made progress, there's still a long way from that. And I do think that as more time goes by, where the Taliban continues to talk to the U.S. and not the Afghan government, you have to worry about trust issues between the Afghan government and the U.S. government, because the Afghan government is understandably concerned that it's being shut out and left on the outside looking in as these two sides move towards some sort of resolution that would have clear, direct implications for the Afghan government.
Well, can the Taliban be trusted in any way, shape, or form? Because as these talks were going on in Doha, attacks were underway in Afghanistan.
Yeah, you're right. And, unfortunately, this is probably going to be something that we see again and again. Even as we continue to have more talks between the U.S. and the Taliban is going to continue to carry out attacks. And the reason it does that is that it's a bargaining tool. It feels that, by keeping up the pressure and by staging these attacks, that helps strengthen its bargaining position, because it could say, well, look, we're still in a position to stage these attacks. And so that's why, if you want to get something done with us, you need to be willing to make some concessions. So unfortunately, that's going to continue to happen. In terms of the broader trust issue, I agree. There's reason to fear that if the U.S. and the Taliban were to agree to a deal in which the U.S. agrees to start withdrawing troops from Afghanistan by X date, that the Taliban would then essentially renege on any type of commitment to lay down its arms and talk to the Afghan government, and instead simply take advantage of what would be a tremendous battlefield advantage if the U.S. were to start withdrawing forces and scale up its fight against the Afghan government. We really have to worry about that. I mean, this is an unprecedented state of affairs. I mean, it's hard to predict what the Taliban will do. I mean, we've never been in this position before where the Taliban has been acting like it's interested in pursuing a peace process, but we just don't know what to expect. But, you know, one more thing I'll say here about the trust issue. The fact that the Taliban appointed one of their top leaders, a guy named Mullah Baradar, to lead the talks from the Taliban side from here on out, that to me suggests a level of seriousness and commitment that we haven't seen to this point, because, you know, let's face it, the Taliban would not bring out its number two leader, and that's essentially what Mullah Baradar had been for quite some time. They wouldn't bring him out to be leading these talks from the Taliban side if it didn't think there was a reason to take them seriously. So I think that's something to keep in mind.
Michael Kugelman of the Wilson Center for Scholars in Washington speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Kugelman also spoke about other countries trying to play a part in a peace deal in Afghanistan. You can hear that part of Ira Melman's conversation with Michael Kugelman tomorrow here on VOA Asia. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Following Huawei indictment, China accuses United States of suppressing Chinese companies. U.S. Intel chief says Russia and China biggest espionage and cyber threats. Foreign journalists in China say working conditions are deteriorating. Myanmar LGBT pride out in force, but laws lag behind. French Spider-Man arrested after scaling Manila skyscraper. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia each and every day, as well as our voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington as VOA Asia continues. An international controversy has quickly developed at Duke University in the normally quiet city of Durham, North Carolina. In a recent email to students, Megan Neely, an assistant professor of biostatistics, related that two faculty members recently approached her asking the identity of two Chinese nationals studying at the medical school. According to Neely, her colleagues thought the students were speaking loudly in Mandarin and wanted to note their names for future studies. Neely used the opportunity to encourage Chinese national students to use English as much as possible. Quote, "I encourage you to commit to using English 100% of the time," Neely wrote. Student reaction was swift and negative, and Neely was released from her responsibilities. But the controversy lives on. Scott Stevens is director of the English Language Institute at the University of Delaware. Stevens told our Doug Bernard there are two basic issues at play.
Well, certainly if this idea of essentially identifying and blacklisting students from potential internships based on what they do outside of classroom, if that gets around, that, you know, that could have a very major dampening effect on and worrisome impact on students who, you know, feel they have to kind of look over their shoulders in terms of what they do in their free time. So I think that's a challenge. But as you said, there's also sort of a kernel of an issue that this Professor Neely was perhaps trying to get at and did in a very clumsy fashion. And that is how one can best take advantage of the opportunity to live and study in another culture. And I think of this from the standpoint of Americans who travel abroad, go to often Western Europe, and often they go in a group and make very little attempt to learn the language and often are seen congregating all the time. And sometimes it perpetuates this stereotype of the ugly American visiting other countries, and it's sort of studying in a bubble. There was a research study recently that showed that 40% of Asian students can go through an entire four-year degree without making a single American friend. And I think that's a sobering and kind of sad commentary, maybe on the extent to which American universities are failing and to make international students feel fully welcome and a part of the campus.
How might universities better integrate international students so they don't just maybe perhaps, not all of them do, but some of them might just congregate with themselves and speak their language and kind of live, as you call it, in that bubble?
Well, I think first it's incumbent on universities to make international students feel fully welcome and fully a part of the academic community. And one of the ways we try to do that at Delaware is we have a mentoring program where we train American undergraduates and graduates in intercultural communication skills, and then we assign them to groups of 7 to 8 international students. And the Americans are tasked really with inviting those international students to their world, introducing them to their American friends, going, having coffee together, going to football games or basketball games, and at the same time modeling the kind of skills they've learned, having spent their entire lives in the American educational system, that international students are trying to adapt to. And so both sides win. You know, American students learn mm-hmm. about other cultures. They learn how to communicate effectively with other cultures. They learn how to be better hosts. And the international students appreciate Americans reaching out to them. You know, I'm always amazed when I travel to other countries how gracious that my hosts are in inviting me to dinner and in making me feel so incredibly welcome. Americans sometimes could do a little bit better job of that, and I think through defined programs, universities can begin to fulfill their aspirations of graduating global citizens, you know, where both Americans and international students benefit from each other's
right.
company.
Right. Very briefly, I've spent any number of years abroad in a variety of situations. One of the things that I've encountered is that if you're in a foreign country and somebody says, would you come over to dinner or will you have dinner with me? They pretty much mean it. And it seems that sometimes when Americans say, hey, let's have dinner sometime, they're not really saying, hey, let's have dinner. It's just sort of an expression of a nicety.
It is true. It's sort of like, hi, how are you?
Yeah.
Professor Scott Stevens of the University of Delaware speaking with VOA Asia's Doug Bernard. Happening now in Asia, Pakistan's Supreme Court has upheld its acquittal of a Christian woman who had been sentenced to death in 2010 for blasphemy against Islam. Chief Justice Asif Saeed Khosa announced the court's decision to reject a petition brought by hardline Islamic leaders asking the court to reinstate the woman's death penalty. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, that you're with us on VOA Asia. India's southern Kochi city in Kerala State is among the world's most innovative airports, completely powered by solar energy. Winner of the United Nations Champions of the Earth Award for Entrepreneurial Vision in 2018, the project is testimony to India's ambitions of rapidly scaling up the use of solar power to reduce its carbon emissions. Anjana Pasricha has this report.
Passengers using Cochin International Airport in Kochi cannot miss the sea of solar panels on a tract of land by the roadside and on the car park, powering India's seventh busiest airport. In a city that lies close to the equator, the sun's energy meets the airport's needs around the clock.
We'll produce the entire energy during these morning 10 hours, and directly we'll use some part of energy, and excess energy we'll bank to grid. And then during night time, we'll take it back.
The project was launched as authorities searched for ways to minimize rising power bills. Doubts about whether the green energy alternative would be financially viable were laid to rest by the falling costs of solar panels.
We get back our investment in less than 6 years' time, so which I thought was an excellent investment opportunity. The next 25 years is meant for all profit. So it has been a good capital investment and environmental friendly also.
After being recognized as the world's first airport fully powered by solar energy in 2015, the airport has been steadily expanding capacity to retain that position. Solar panels are being placed wherever possible, such as the car park and on top of a 2-kilometer canal. The carbon emissions reduced over 25 years will be equivalent to planting 3 million trees, according to estimates. And to make the green project even greener, vegetables are being grown under the solar panels. The initiative is getting attention. The project has also generated interest in some African countries.
We have signed an MOU with the government of Ghana. We have had a team from Liberia, who were all interested in us helping them to put up solar panels in their own country, especially in the airport sector.
The Cochin Airport is seen as a model of how, from office and household rooftops to big infrastructure projects, sun-drenched India is scaling up solar power. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Kochi.
Coming up, connecting on social media might become easier. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia, Chinese authorities and telecom giant Huawei have reacted swiftly to indictments U.S. federal prosecutors announced against the company and its chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou. Meng's lawyer has argued she's being used as a pawn or hostage in the relationship between the United States and China. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Manila Bay is cleaning up, and a social media conglomerate is being built for you. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
The environmental cleanup of Manila Bay in the Philippines has officially launched. Dubbed the Battle for Manila Bay by the Department of the Environment and Natural Resources, the project will involve environmental cleanup, the relocation of illegal settlers, and the enforcement of environmental laws. Roy Simatu is the environmental minister of the Philippines.
Jales was only dubbed as the battle for Manila Bay, but we will deal with it right from the source, from the illegal water discharge of abusive establishments, down to the waterways, creeks and rivers that lead to Manila Bay. We cannot afford to prolong this cleanup activity because it has been long neglected. What we failed to clean up in the past should be dealt with accordingly today.
The Ministry of the Environment has suspended the permits of dozens of businesses along the Baywalk and creeks leading to Manila Bay until they have complied with sanitation laws. Slums along rivers in Manila Bay are also being relocated. The project is modeled on President Rodrigo Duterte's cleanup program on Boracay Island last year, during which the entire island was shut down and hundreds of Boracay hotels, restaurants, and tour operators had to renegotiate their business deals. Bernadette Romulo Puya is the Philippine tourism minister.
We believe that the Boracay experience has become an effective template and speedy route to aligning to the path of sustainable tourism.
The Manila Bay Rehabilitation Project began on January 27th with a solidarity walk and will last for approximately 6 months. Three of the world's largest messaging networks, Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, are going to be integrated, allowing people to send messages across platforms. While the three services will remain standalone apps, a Facebook user will soon be able to message a WhatsApp user, who will likewise be able to message an Instagram user. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg also said he plans to improve privacy on the platforms by including end-to-end encryption. Some analysts say the move comes as a reaction to regulatory and antitrust challenges Facebook could face in the future. The integration plan is in its early stages with a tentative goal of completion by the end of 2019. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, U.S. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats told lawmakers Tuesday North Korea is unlikely to completely dismantle its nuclear arsenal. Coats said North Korea is unlikely to completely give up its nuclear weapons and production capability because its leaders ultimately view nuclear weapons as critical to regime survival. More on this is on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, blockchain technology, a high-tech way to securely manage and protect, is best known as the driver of the cryptocurrency Bitcoin. Now a U.S. coffee importer is using it to improve the lives of coffee farmers and some of the poorest communities in Central America. VOA's Faith Lapidus brews details.
Ivan Herrera grows coffee in the hills above Santa Rosa de Lima, 40 kilometers outside Guatemala's capital city. She's proud of her crop.
We're going to pick a great coffee. That's what we've been working towards, and this year we're seeing the result of 2 years' hard work.
Like most of the world's coffee farmers, Herrera used to sell her product on the International Coffee Futures Market, where buyers agree to purchase the beans at a predetermined price for a future delivery date. That depresses prices and leaves them vulnerable to currency fluctuation. But now, Herrera sells directly to an independent coffee roaster in the United States and gets a premium price. The system is the brainchild of Paul Tupper and his brother Scott, who harnessed a successful blockchain technology business in Seattle to tackle the issue of environmental sustainability in the developing world.
Anyone who's a fan of coffee and many other goods has seen the proliferation of standards and certifications that are out on the market. And it can be confusing for a consumer. Blockchain can lay on top of all of this as a way to verify what's actually going on financially and socially.
Blockchain technology creates a ledger to record, manage, and confirm transactions transparently and verifiably by all stakeholders, such as the coffee grower, the importer, and the roaster. The brothers' company, Onda Origins, believes that enough consumers will care about where their coffee comes from to pay for quality roasted small batch beans, so it can pay its growers a premium price that exceeds even standard fair trade coffee. The guaranteed higher prices will allow growers like Yvonne Herrera to not only invest in and protect her land, but also pay better wages to her workers, raising the standard of living across her community. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
More water is apparently flowing into oceans, as VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to explain.
This is Science in a Minute.
A recent U.S.-Dutch study outlined evidence that the Antarctic ice sheet is losing about 6 times the ice each year than it did back 40 years ago. Now, another new study suggests that accelerating ice melt is also taking place in Greenland, which is mostly located within the Arctic Circle. The study proposes that Greenland ice is melting faster than had been thought and that it could lead to a faster rise in sea level. The researchers place the blame of the accelerated ice loss on what they call the increasing warming of Earth's atmosphere. Since most of southwest Greenland, the area the researchers focused on, doesn't have glaciers, the study proposes that the lost ice must be actual surface ice. The study found that the largest continuous loss of Greenland ice took place from early 2003 to mid-2013. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll also find us on Facebook in a couple of different places. VOA Asia Facebook, of course, is our very own page that we post many great stories on each and every day and stream this program. Our program is also found on VOA Burmese Facebook. And we thank everyone in Myanmar who tuned into our program via Facebook today. We'd also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we wish you a nice day ahead.